Good afternoon, you are tuned into a Juno afternoon here for Tuesday, February 2nd, the year 2016. Jeff Brown is here today. We'll get an update on library activities with Beth Weigel and Colette Costin, Robin Waltz. Carl Broderson will be here with details about this Friday's World Quest event. We'll get a preview of Tuesday's Juno World Affairs Council presentation on U.S. nuclear policy with guest Paul Carroll. Heather Hoglund will be here to highlight this week's Salsa classes, and we'll learn about career and technological education activities with guest Karen Smolin from the Juno School District. That Writer's Almanac, Burnout Music, and more today on a Juno afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, rain likely, mixing with snow later on, about 1 inch expected. Forecast for Wednesday, rain mixed with snow in the morning within Lindenhall Valley. Little or no snow accumulation expected.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Indian Health Service is sending additional personnel and assigning a new temporary leader to the Great Plains Service Area. The changes are addressed in a letter from the IHS to tribal leaders. The Argus leader posted the letter online, which is dated February 1st. The action comes as health officials are set to testify Wednesday at the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hearing, re-examining the substandard quality of Indian health care in the Great Plains. Tribal leaders are among those advocating for better care, specifically on the Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations in South Dakota. Meanwhile, some Native business leaders in South Dakota say a commercial airing on TV in the Black Hills is positive and encourages financial literacy. As Charles Michael Ray reports, a credit union is reaching out to Lakota people by using their native language.
Two Lakota versions of the Black Hills Federal Credit Union commercial are airing, one with a Lakota female dialect and one with a male. A third version of the commercial is in English, and the voices in all three commercials are over images of a family traveling towards the Black Hills.
It's because there's one thing that's worth more than all of it put together, family.
For Tanya Fiddler, the ads in Lakota are a positive step forward.
They point to the diversity of our state and offer a new effort at inclusion.
Fiddler is a business leader who's working on economic development in Indian country with the Native CDFI network.
We bring not only culture and heritage as assets to the state, but the resources that come in from our reservation communities as well.
Other business leaders agree. Lakota Maurer is with the Four Bands Community Fund on the Cheyenne River Reservation. She says the ad speaks to the importance of building financial literacy in tribal communities.
Sort of makes it our own. It makes it more Lakota and allows us to decide what financial literacy is for ourselves.
Officials at Black Hills Federal Credit Union say they chose to put out the commercials in Lakota as a way to honor the importance of Lakota language and culture in the Black Hills and as a way to recognize the important contribution Lakota people make to the economy. I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Navajo Nation was without a collegiate basketball team for nearly three decades, but this season marks the sport's return to Dene College. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The 1,400-student community college in the eastern portion of the Navajo Nation competes in archery, rodeo, and cross-country, but it's been without men's and women's basketball since the late 80s. Dene College athletic director and head men's basketball coach Warlance Foster set out last year to bring the sport back.
It's almost like a dream. It's almost like I close my eyes and say, what would I dream about if I could give something to my Navajo people? I said, a top-notch athletic program.
Foster says he recruited players from campus pickup games and even approached students between classes who were wearing basketball apparel. Foster says though he's passionate about the sport, his main goal in reviving the program is the education of his players.
At the end of the day, when you're done running cross-country, rodeoing, archery, basketball, you got to have that degree to fall back on. So that's what was the foundation of starting basketball back up here.
Foster's mother taught him the game and even played basketball for Dene College in the 70s when it was called Navajo Community College. He played college basketball and was briefly an alternate in the NBA for the Denver Nuggets. The Dene College Warriors saw their share of losses this season and often trailed opponents by 30 or more points. But Foster reiterates that education is the most important factor and not necessarily the wins and losses. As the program develops, he wants to compete against bigger state teams like Northern Arizona University and Arizona State. The men's and women's Warriors will play the final games of their season later this month. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at knba.org.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into it June afternoon. Jeff Brown is your host today. I have in the studio my first few guests, Beth Weigel, Colette Costa, and Robin Wall, here to talk about how science and commerce reconfigured the grotesque body. I'm going to let them explain more about that.
Right. So thanks, Jeff. This is all part of our Science on Screen program that we've paired up. This is a great collaboration here. So Colette at the Gold Town is going to be showing films. Robin at the university, Robin Walls, history professor, he's going to be speaking about Elephant Man, the film that we're showing, and the library is just helping put it all together and showing the film, too. So we're excited about this project. We had a grant that we received from Science on Screen, which is a grant-funded project by the Coolidge Theater Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. And basically, we pair up films, classic cult films, documentaries, things like that, with lively presentations by notable speakers. And this month, our notable speaker is Robin Walls. So, we're very excited.
Golf clap.
Yes. So he has very graciously agreed to talk not only at the Sound and Motion event on Friday, but also at the theater when we show the free screenings of the film Elephant Man about Elephant Man. And you want to tell us a little bit about what that Elephant Man talk is going to be about, Robin?
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be about Joseph Merrick, whom we all call John Merrick because that's what he's called in the film. And there's a story even there, so you can come and find the story of like how the names got all mixed up. Joseph Merrick was born in Leicester, England, and as a child started developing these growths and stuff, but went to school, you know, did stuff like other folks, you know, when he was done with elementary school, which was all you got in those days, he went to work in a cigar factory for a while, rolling cigars, but then his left hand, so he couldn't use it very well, and then his mom had died, and his dad had married his landlady, and she's like an evil Disney stepmother, and bugged him about being a lazy bum, and he had to go sell wares. And actually, when he got to go to the sideshow business, he kind of liked it. He actually made money. He made money. In two years, he saved 50 pounds, which was as much as like an entire worker made in a year in England. So the image of him being like horribly exploited and chained, you know, this creepy David Lynch set, you know, that's not entirely true. But he did reach a point where like he could not really function anymore, and that's where this guy Dr. Treves and the London Royal Hospital steps in, and the last 3 years of his life, that's where he lives.
So that's a really interesting tale of the real person, and
Right. We're
kind of putting this talk up against the David Lynch film, which you just referenced, and how that's very different. And I think you're going to talk a little bit about how science and commerce then reconfigured sort of his role and his body and things like that in your talk, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Here I'm relying on an authority, a curator of something called a woman named Gretchen Warden, who was the curator of the Muter Museum in Philadelphia. It's an anatomical museum. And she talks about how in the 19th century, sort of like science and these sideshows, like they're dealing with the same people. And they're actually like not all that dissimilar in the way that they're talking about people and viewing them and putting them on view.
Display.
Yeah, on display and stuff. And so I'm going to be tying that back around, I think, eventually to the topic of disabilities history today,
mm-hmm.
and disabilities studies, and the idea that, not everything has to be normalized, and everything has to be like medically corrected, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're pretty tuned into those things, I think, more today.
Right. So it's okay to be different, is what you're saying.
It is okay to be different, yeah.
I think we've sort of moved the sideshow to YouTube now. you can sort of privately indulge your... I mean, I hate to admit, I kind of did that the other day when I was looking for little videos to put on about the Elephant Man, the movie, and the person to Facebook just to sort of whet interest. And of course, you get down the YouTube vortex of... the woman with no face, and the guy with a hole in his head, and it goes on and on. And I realized, oh, my God, this is... And I'm doing this while I'm watching the trailer for The Elephant Man, which is all very David Lynch and sideshow. And I was like, I am at the new sideshow, and I can very safely do it where, quote-unquote, nobody knows I'm watching.
Yeah.
But they all do.
Google knows.
Google knows everything,
yeah.
They know my birthday.
So this is the very first, or second, actually, film in our series on the Science on Screen, series of films that we'll be putting together. And we're excited to pair up with the University of Alaska Southeast for the Sound mm-hmm. and Motion Talk this Friday. I believe, Colette, you are going to have the shows for free, right,
mm-hmm.
on Sunday.
The Sunday shows, 4 p.m. and 7 p.m., will be free. I will be doing a short introduction to the film itself before the 4 p.m., possibly before the 7 if we have time. The talk will be in between the two shows, so probably right about 6:30 or so.
So Robin will be there for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so mm-hmm. stick if you go to the 4, just stick around. If you're coming to the 7, get there about half an hour early. And then it just folds over. And then I also added shows. If you can't make it that day, so there will be a 7 p.m. show on Monday and a 7 p.m. show on Wednesday of next week. And those will be regular rates.
Right. And then at the library, we're going to show the film again, Elephant Man, at the Valley Library on the 26th of February. That's a Friday, and it's a day off from school. And it will come right after our Science Friday program, which is the science of accessibility. So we're going to learn how adaptive equipment and technology provides access and inclusion for people who experience disabilities. We'll have an artist and accessibility activist there to talk a little bit about his life, and some of our friends from SAIL and ORCA will be there to show some of the gear that's used that gets everybody involved in the outdoor activities. So we'll have that at 1 o'clock till 3 o'clock, and that's generally, sort of a 7 to 14-year-old aged program, and then we'll show the film at 3:30, and that's later on in the month on Friday, February the 26th. But it's going to be pretty exciting, and we'll have some more Science on Screen programming that happens in March. Just to give a quick little preview, we'll have Hank Lenfer coming over from Gustavus to talk about the science of recording the sounds of nature, and that'll be March 22nd, which will also be part of the National Evening of Science on Screen. So all the theaters, small theaters, and we're really the only library that's involved, but a lot of small theaters that receive this grant will all be doing some sort of program that night, so it's going to be all tied together that way nationally, and he'll be doing his talk, and we'll be showing a film called A Birder's Guide to Everything. So that should be a really fun film as well for all of our nature enthusiasts out there.
I think that's also our sort of family-friendly
right.
film. I think it's rated PG maybe, and
right.
and it stars a bunch of kids, so right. it'll have a nice tie-in with that.
Yeah, it's about a young boy who thinks he's made this mm. miraculous discovery of a new species, I think, and he and his friends go on a big adventure, birding adventure, and he's kind of avoiding a lot of his family, dynamics, where his dad's getting remarried and stuff like that. So it should be a great film. I believe Elephant Man is also rated PG-13, so.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, so it should be relatively friendly, too, to all ages, appropriate somewhat.
Yeah, I would say.
It's a little dark at times.
I would say not under 14. I think it's got some disturbing thematic elements.
Right.
I don't know. There's no violence or swearing in it, but it's David Lynch.
Can we say more?
And then we're going to finish our series in May with Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, Marilyn Monroe, and Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. We're still working out details on the speaker for that.
Focusing on gender and
gender issues.
Yeah, transgender, gender identity, things like
Marilyn
that.
Monroe. I'm looking forward to all of these. I'm very much looking forward to having some classic cinema, though.
Yeah.
Sure.
So we're going to come back in a couple weeks here and talk a little bit more about some of the things going on at the library, because we wanted to focus today just on Science on Screen. But don't forget to check our website at juno.org/library for all the events happening at the library. Our calendar is posted there. We've got some great things happening and starting up, including a junior Lego league. So if you're a Lego fan, now your youngsters, your younger children can get involved in that. So check our website, pick up our calendar, give us a call at the library. You can find out everything.
All right. Thanks, Beth Weigel, Robin Walls, and Clyde Costa for coming down. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
You can check out more information on the whole program on our website as well, goldtownnick.com. Tickets are at the door. There are no tickets because it's free. And thank you, Jeff, for just being so brown. So, Jeff Brown.
All right.
Oh, happy Groundhog's Day.
Happy
oh, my God.
Happy Groundhog's Day.
Oh,
again?
Oh my God. Again.
All right, thanks for coming by.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 2nd of February, 2016. It's the birthday of James Joyce, born in Dublin, 1882, who said, "The demand that I make of my reader is that he should devote his whole life to reading my works." James Joyce, who wrote Ulysses, 1922, Finnegan's Wake, 1939, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, 1916, and his short story collection Dubliners in 1914. He was educated by Jesuits, first visited a prostitute at the age of 14, dropped out of medical school, wanted to be an opera star, and then he met and fell in love with a hotel maid from Galway named Nora Barnacle when he was 22, and he set the action of his book Ulysses on the day he had his first date with her, June 16, 1904, now commemorated all over the world each year as Bloom's Day, after the protagonist of Ulysses, Leopold Bloom. He convinced Nora to leave Ireland with him and elope to Europe, where he did all his best work and where they were forever impoverished, constantly relying on his brother Stanislaus for money. They had a son, Giorgio, and after that they slept head to foot and attempted birth control. But then Nora became pregnant with Lucia about a year later. James Joyce was a doting father, liked to spoil his kids, never punished either one of them, told an interviewer, "Children must be educated by love, not punishment." James Joyce was afraid of thunder and lightning. He'd go hide under the bed whenever it struck. And he was afraid of dogs. He walked around town with rocks in his pockets so he could throw them at any dogs who came near him. He loved music and literature, but he had no patience for art, for painting. On his desk, he had a tiny bronze statue of a woman lying back in a chair with a cat draped over her shoulders, which all of his friends told him was ugly, but he kept it on his desk anyway. One of his friends said he had no taste, only genius. He liked to drink and he liked to dance, and his daughter-in-law said that liquor went to his feet, not his head. He usually sat with his legs crossed, with the toe of one crossed again under the calf of the other. He was kind and generous to strangers. He would invite waiters to come sit down at his table. His friend Sylvia Beach said that Joyce treated people invariably as his equals, whether they were writers, children, waiters, princesses, or charladies. If he arrived in a taxi, he wouldn't get out until the driver had finished what he was saying. And Joyce himself fascinated everybody. Nobody could resist his charm. James Joyce, who said, "The artist, like the god of the creation, remains within or behind or beyond or above his handiwork, invisible, refined, out of existence, indifferent, paring his fingernails." Here's a poem for today by January Gill O'Neill, "What Love Cannot Do." It cannot save itself when it expires, like a tire's slow leak. It cannot bring back the greediness of youth, mouth on mouth, skin on skin, that gnawing, that longing you carried until the next time, and then there is no next time. You never see it coming, but always see it leaving. It waits by the door, bags packed full of stones from your life. What it can do is mark the distance between point A and point B, which feels like a galaxy. Every star you ever wished upon imploding before your eyes. What Love Cannot Do, a poem by January Gill O'Neill from Misery Islands, published by Cavan Carey Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering coffee break service for the office, delivering fresh roasted coffees, brewing equipment, and beverage supplies to offices and businesses around Southeast. Information at heritagecoffee.com.
It's about 1 minute past the hour, and you're tuned to KTUO News at Juneau, and also KRNN FM, Arts and Culture for the Capital City. Jeff Brown on Juneau Afternoon today, and our next guest is Carl Brodersen from the World Defense Council. They're here to talk about WorldQuest.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. How are you?
Just fine. To start out, for people who don't know what the World Affairs Council is, could you please give an overview, please?
Absolutely. I have a very handy paragraph here. The Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization. Our goal is to encourage dialogue and understanding of important international, economic, political, and social issues through expert presentation, informed discussion, and other educational activities. We bring the world to Juneau. So what that means is we bring folks who know what they're talking about from out of town to come and tell us about the world, and it's extremely informative and interesting.
In fact, we've got a speaker tonight, Paul Carroll.
Yes, we do. Looking forward to him.
It's the 12th annual WorldQuest.
Yeah.
Friday the 5th at Centennial Hall. It's the largest fundraiser of the year. What does it support?
For us, it supports, in large part, the plane tickets to get those folks up here. It's not free to have folks come to town, so we have a budget, and this is how we fill it with just a giant trivia night.
How much are your tickets, and how do people get them?
They are $65 or $40 for students, and you can get them at the door, which is what 90% of Juneau does, or you can get them online through our website or at the Jack.
Now, they assemble in teams. Sometimes they have a team prearranged ahead of time, and sometimes it just happens on the fly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so it's your team is who you're having dinner with. You're just seated at a dinner table after the buffet, and then you start playing a game. It's groups of eight. We can cram 9 or 10 in there if you want, but it doesn't always make it more likely that you're going to win more. If anything, more people usually makes it harder because there's always one person who knows the right answer, and it turns out it's wrong. But you can also just show up with 4 people or even just one if you want. Don't feel like you have to arrange something big ahead of time. Just walk into the room, find a spot, and go from there.
What does it feature?
It features a no-host bar. There's the usual array of dessert and silent auctions, and then our trivia night. I think it's the best one in town, but I write it, so I'm obligated to say that. It's a bunch of questions. It's kind of like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego meets Jeopardy. It covers a little bit about Alaska. There's a year in review, and then just a bunch of random items that you might know about. And it's really fun and entertaining, and it's hard, and I learn a lot putting it together, but it's fun. It's not about whether you know or not. It's just about the experience. It's about being in the room and enjoying it.
And you got about 50 questions?
Yeah, it's 50 questions. I guess it's sort of more than that now because I think 8 of the questions are divided into 8 sub-questions just so that you can go quickly. A big fun part of trivia is, what flag is this? What flag is this? What flag is this? What's the capital of this? Who is that? Who is that? Who is that? And you can't have, an entire question just about, is this Queen Victoria or not? And so if you throw a bunch of them at people rapid fire and they're only worth a quarter point each, then that provides an opportunity for all that just random trivial knowledge to be properly utilized.
And to get people going, you've got a couple of good MCs.
Yes, yes. This year we have Jesse Kilo's coming back. We're very grateful for that. And then Colette Costa is going to join us. You just heard her. We're very excited about this duo. I think they're going to do a fantastic job.
This happens in other parts of the country.
It does, yeah. It's actually a national event. So the Juneau World Affairs Council is under the umbrella organization, the World Affairs Councils of America, and this is their go-to fundraiser. And there are question banks that you can use to assemble these events. Every World Affairs Council that I know of puts one on at some point during the year. And frankly, they're full of just terrible questions. They're really boring and esoteric, and it's just awful. And the first year I was put in charge of this, I very timidly asked our board president if I could maybe write some by myself, and he said, of course, do whatever you want to do. And it spiraled out of control from there, and it's just been great.
How do you get ready for something like this?
Well, I still like my favorite glib answer that I gave you 5 or 6 years ago, which was memorize the internet, which you've never let me forget, and I apologize for that. Read through the 2015 Wikipedia page. That's where I start every single year. And then from there, I don't know, just sort of pay attention to the news. Reading The Economist is always a good option, even though I don't have a subscription. It always seems to line up reasonably well with things that they're interested in. But it really is just random and varied. So just show up and be ready to have fun.
All right. And it starts at 6 o'clock. What's on the menu?
Oh, gosh. I don't honestly know. I'm usually so distracted during this event that I rarely get dinner. There's chicken satay, I think. There's probably a little bit of rice, something from every continent, which I guess would imply that there's penguin skewers. I don't think we actually have those. So there's something from all 6 of the continents. And then, oh, but ice. There's probably ice. So there you go, 7. But it's delicious. We keep getting compliments back from folks. They really enjoy it. And it's a good evening. And if you price it out over 4 hours, it's not that expensive. So, yeah, it's entertaining.
Colin Bernison, tell us once more how to get tickets.
One more time. You can go to our website. It's jwac.org. We're very Googleable. You can also get them at the Jack or from their website. You can go to Hearthside and Rainy Day Books, and you can always get them at the door. We've only run out once, and we just put out more tables, so it worked out fine.
Carl, thanks for coming down.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, she sneaks around the world from Vienna to Carolina. Sticky fingered filcher from Berlin down to Belize. Take me for a ride on a notebook to China. Tell me, where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
Steal their soul in South Korea. They can let it come right off from the Red Sea to Greenland. They'll be singing the blues. Well, they never Arkansas heard steal. To me, come from the jungle.
The world is
Carmen Sandiego.
She goes from Nashville to Norway, out and to Zimbabwe, Chicago to Czechoslovakia and back.
Well, she'll run down Pakistan and run again in Scandinavia. Then she'll take them up down under and go big pocket first. She puts the miss and misdemeanor when she stole the beans from Lima. Tell me, where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
Be.
Ooh, Botswana, to Thailand, Zealandia, to Mali, to Bali, Ohio, Ohio!
Around the globe, banks should flip them every nation. She's a double feeling diva with a taste for thievery. Her itinerary's loaded up with moving violations. Tell me, where in the world is
Carmen Sandiego?
Oh, tell me,
where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Tell me,
where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Where could she be?
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
It's about halfway past the hour, and you're tuned into Juneau Afternoon here on PTO and KRNN. In the studio with me now is Carl, Jim Clark, Bob Schroeder, and Paul Carroll, here to talk about what Paul's going to be talking about tonight. Thank you very much for coming down to the station. Jim, you want to introduce the...
Well, Paul is here tonight with the Juneau World Affairs Council, and that talk is going to be held at 5 o'clock in the KTOO studios downstairs from broadcast booth here, and we're very excited to have
Paul, and he'll explain a little bit what he's going to talk about. But let me first say that the Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization. Our goal is to encourage dialogue and understanding of important international economic, political, and social issues through expert presentation, informed discussion, and other education activities. We bring the world to Juneau. And with that said, I'd like to remind people, as Carl did just a moment ago, to come to WorldQuest on Friday night at 6 o'clock at Centennial Hall. I think they'll find it a very entertaining evening. The trivia contest based on world events that Carl has very cleverly put together, and I think people will enjoy that. But to the present, we have been very, very fortunate with our speaker tonight. We're very, very pleased he's here, and I'll leave it to you to have him explain what he's going to talk about.
Pretty much you're going to be talking about the U.S. nuclear policy, the arms race sequel. But before we get to that, a little bit about your background.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me. This is my second trip to Juneau, and it's been wonderful. A lot of good memories here from just a few years back. My background is I grew up and sort of came of age in the early 80s when nuclear weapons issues were basically everyday headlines, and that has fallen off the radar of many people. And tonight I'd like to sort of explore with folks in Juneau, you know, why that's happened, explain to people what our current nuclear weapons landscape looks like, both nationally and globally. Talk a little bit also, I expect, about North Korea and Iran. I've been to Alaska 3 times. I've been to North Korea 2 times. So I could give a little bit of a behind-the-curtain view, if you will. I used to work in Congress in the Department of Energy, but don't hold that against me. I've, for the last 15 or 16 years, been working with an organization called the Plowshares Fund, which is a foundation that invests in people working to reduce nuclear dangers and reduce and ultimately eliminate nuclear weapons.
The arms race, how did it get started?
Well, for the listeners of a certain age, the arms race has a very specific meaning. This was the height of the Cold War when the Soviet Union existed, when the United States and the Soviets were in a rivalry, a nuclear rivalry, and we were building weapons and missiles and aircraft at a rapid pace. And ultimately, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the Soviet Union, one way you might look at it is we outspent them. Our piggy bank was a little bit bigger, and theirs collapsed. And now, fast forward 25, 26 years later, and although there are far fewer weapons in the world, we're about to embark on a fairly expensive program to buy new weapons and weapons delivery systems. So we're looking, I mean, I'm very aware that it's Groundhog Day today, and we've seen this movie before, and I'd like to discuss with people what they think about these plans.
What in general is the U.S. nuclear policy?
Well, it's a little bit of a schizophrenic one, I feel. We have actually not just the current president, but every president since the end of World War II, has at least rhetorically stated their intention to reduce and ultimately help eliminate weapons from the planet with varying degrees of success or progress. In this case, the current nuclear policy of the United States is that we shall only use nuclear weapons to deter others from attacking us with them. And that guarantee extends to some key allies as well. Beyond that, it's more art than science. And depending on the current occupant of the White House, depending on the Congress, it varies between growing the arsenal or modernizing it and reducing it or leaving it as is.
What is the current situation in Korea and Iran compared with what's happened in the past?
North Korea is a really tough nut to crack, and I'd be really interested to explore this with folks tonight. They represent not only an incredibly tyrannical regime, but they represent the most, I think, among the most dangerous nuclear proliferants at the moment. Although they are heavily sanctioned, they have figured out a way to continue to test their weapons, albeit slowly, but very methodically. And currently, we're not talking to the North, nor are the Russians or the Chinese. And so they are they're sort of getting a pass at the moment. Iran, I actually think, is a good news story. We have just concluded a deal, not just the United States, but the international community, that cuts off their paths to a nuclear bomb. Now, they're not good guys by any stretch of the imagination, but they have agreed to greatly roll back their nuclear capacity.
You've been in Juneau several days. You talked to people in high school and the UAS, and you're speaking tonight before the World Affairs Council. What has been the people's reaction? What kind of questions do they ask you?
Well, there's definitely a big generational divide. The folks I spoke with last night at UAS were certainly folks who remembered, by and large, duck and cover drills. They know what the arms race is. They know some of the lingo from the 70s and 80s. But it was a very good discussion. They were very interested in learning more about the details of the nuclear deal with Iran, more about some of the details of the current nuclear weapons states, of which there are nine. The high schools the last 2 days, I was really impressed and came out very encouraged. Some students had clearly done their homework and read some things, but by and large, this was news to them that the global landscape still includes about 15,000 nuclear weapons. And so they wanted to know why that is, which countries have them, why is it that we have them, things like that. It was invigorating.
Quick take on Iran.
Well, my quick take on Iran is, as much as my organization and my perspective was that the Iran deal is a very good deal, it is incredibly comprehensive and intrusive in terms of our inspections, and it technically went into effect on January 16th, the heavy lifting begins now. I mean, the negotiations were very difficult and long, but we now have a 10 and 15-year time frame through which they are obligated to continue to restrain their program. And if we stop paying attention, that's when we get into trouble.
You're speaking tonight downstairs in the TV studio?
Right.
What's your presentation going to include?
Well, I would like to include whatever people want to hear about, but I think you've touched on three of the key issues. I want to cover certainly the North Korean threat. They just detonated their fourth weapon, 3 weeks ago? January 6th, excuse me. I think the Iran deal is very important for people to understand and ask questions about. There certainly are valid critiques and questions about it. And I also think, given that we are in the United States, that it's important for people to understand what the current plans and, frankly, ambitions for U.S. nuclear weapons are.
Do you think it's reality to not be concerned about Korea?
Oh, I think it's very realistic to be concerned about Korea. But I think it's important for people to understand the difference and the distinction between the rhetoric and the reality of the threat. They are a nascent and growing threat. They are not a threat in the immediate sense in terms of their nuclear program. They've been a threat for a long time in terms of their belligerence and their rhetoric, particularly to South Korea. But in terms of a deliverable nuclear weapon to the shores of the U.S. or even, frankly, to Japan or South Korea, it's not there yet, but it could be soon.
You listen more to Paul Carroll tonight downstairs. Jim, what time is it starting?
5 o'clock down in the KTOO studio tonight. And we'd welcome anybody that wants to come. It's for free.
All right. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, I hope people come as well. This is something that, as much as I recognize, Juneau is a beautiful and also somewhat isolated place, and certainly not in the lower 48. The topic we are talking about touches every living thing on the planet, potentially.
Well, Bob and Jim, thank you for coming down.
Thank you very much.
Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. Anyone has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. Anyone has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You gotta wonder who they might drop one on. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You've got to ask yourself who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? Anyone in the world has their own.
the triggers and how every day the risk gets bigger. Someone, somewhere in the world will use one of their atom bombs. You've got to ask yourself who gets to decide.
Local Juno at John Palms. 40 minutes past the hour, you're tuned to Juno Afternoon. In the studio with me next is Heather Hoglund, here to talk about salsa dancing.
That's right. So, I'm the salsa lady.
What turned you on to salsa?
Oh, let's see. You know what it was? Rob Cohen introduced me to Cuban music when I went to his shop and said, I'd like to get some salsa music. And he said, oh, my gosh, you have to listen to this CD. It's Afro-Cuban All-Stars. And that music made me want to go to Cuba really badly. So that's where it started. I went to Cuba and... then, since then, I've gone 7 times, spent at least 6 or 7 months there total. So that's what made me fall in love with salsa.
And you teach it?
Yes, I do.
What's the secret in teaching salsa? Or what's the secret to learning salsa?
I guess just have fun, relax. The kind of style that I teach is very social, it's not about performance or showing off. It's just about enjoying the music and really feeling the music and not just doing steps.
How long have you been teaching?
Now it'll be 12 years, and I have to thank Juno for putting up with me as I learned how to teach. I taught here from about 2012, oh gosh, I can't even remember now, 2003 to 2009, probably when I taught here.
So when you're not here, how can people learn salsa dancing?
There is some salsa going on. I think that Mark Hobson teaches some classes maybe at UAS, but I'm sorry I don't have the details on me. If you come to the class, then you will get all the details on what's going on in salsa in Juno right now without me.
Are there videos available?
Certainly. Well, my favorite kind of salsa is Cuban salsa, and you can look up Cuban salsa online and see what it looks like. The word for Cuban salsa that Cubans use is casino. That's the style of dance, and they call it casino.
What makes Cuban salsa different than other kinds?
Well, there's a few things. One of the most important things is that Cuban salsa is really grounded because of its African roots. And so you're not going to see a lot of dancing on your toes or spins. You're going to see a lot of body core motion, a lot of hips and shoulders and waist. And so it's really grounded, and a lot of the accents have these African roots. So that's a really cool thing about Cuban salsa. Another thing about Cuban salsa is that it's really in tune to the music. So if you go to a Cuban salsa party, people are going to be singing along with the songs as they're dancing, and they're going to really connect their motions to what the song is doing, whether it's an intro or whether it's a romantic song or whether it's slower or faster. It has dramatic punches. It's just very in tune with the music. And then the third thing I love about Cuban salsa is that it's very playful. As I mentioned, it doesn't take itself too seriously. It's about social interaction, having fun, enjoying your partner, enjoying the music.
Tell me about the classes. You just flew in.
I flew in this morning, or this afternoon. So tomorrow evening at Suite 907, I'll be teaching a beginning salsa workshop at 6 o'clock. That'll go 6 to 7:15. And if you want to stick around and brave level 2, that'll go 7:30 to 8:45. And that's 21 and over unless you have a parent or guardian. And there will be some drink specials going on, too, with mojitos.
And what does it cost?
It costs $12 for the first class or $20 for both classes.
Is there a general rule of thumb or toe to what you should wear?
What you should wear is something comfortable, something you can sweat in, and ladies, leave the high heels at home because, as I said, this is a grounded dance. You're not going to be spinning around a lot on your toes, and you'll definitely be more comfortable. And then, nothing too fancy. Maybe layers just so you can take them off as you start sweating.
How do you sign up?
You just register at the door. There's no pre-registration necessary, and you definitely don't need a partner. So everyone is welcome to come with or without a partner.
And remind us again, time and
Sure. Suite 907, 6 o'clock for the beginning, 6 to 7:15 for level 1, and then 7:30 to 8:45 for level 2. I do have one other event, if you don't mind me mentioning it.
Please do.
All right. Friday night at the Jack, ballroom dance at the Jack program, we're going to do a Latin night, or are we calling it Viva Cuba, Latin dance party. So that's going to be 7:30 to 10:30. I'll teach a lesson from 8 to around 8:30 or 9, and we'll be doing mostly salsa, but a lot of bachata, merengue, reggaeton, cha-cha, other kinds of Latin rhythms, maybe a couple tangos in there too. So it should be a fun night, and that's a suggested $10 donation at the door, all ages at the Jack, Friday night, 7:30.
Okay, Auglin, thank you for coming down.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Minutes before the hour, and you are tuned in to a Juno afternoon. Our next guest is Karen Smolin. She's here to talk about National Career and Technical Education Month. Karen, thank you for coming down the station.
Thank you.
All right. So tell me about Career and Technical Education Month.
Well, it's a national celebration of our programs. The term used to be vocational ed, but it's career and technical education. That's the language we use now. And this is the good news, things to celebrate that are going on in our school district. And I'd like to highlight some things for you, lots of things for you.
Please do.
So I think what's interesting is that last year we had over 1,000 kids take at least one career and technical education course or vocational course over the year. And those students do really well in school based on the reports that they are students who graduate high school as well. And do well in their futures.
What kind of classes do they take?
Well, our courses and some of our key highlights are courses from house build, which I want to tell you about, and computer-assisted drafting. We have fisheries courses. We have health sciences courses. So we have a lot of trades, health sciences, fisheries, and even engineering classes and culinary classes and business classes. So a variety of courses that our high school specialize in. And, in fact, at JD High, there's computer-assisted drafting and woods classes and auto mechanics classes and our house build class, where we're currently building two houses out at Lena Loop in partnership with the Juneau Housing Trust and the University of Alaska. And we're building two affordable houses. One of them should be finished by May, and the other one will be finished next fall. And they're really great places that the Juneau Housing Trust will be selling and working towards with an affordable home buyer for.
The amount of students you have is really impressive.
Yeah. There are 12 kids in that program alone. So that's in the high school house build.
And you had over 1,000 high school students enrolled in at least one career
in at least one career and tech ed course. They've taken anything from the trades to health science to business to even our video production class. And so I have many other highlights to share with you about those classes.
Please do.
Okay. let's see. We've got a robotics club at Thunder Mountain High School where there are girls, a girls team and two other teams won the regional competition last week, and they're going to the state competition. So they swept all first, second, and third places in the regional. We have a marine biology classes at Thunder Mountain High School where they are working with the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, and they are deconstructing and rebuilding the skeletons of a walrus, a beluga whale, and a harbor seal. So they are learning about marine habitat and doing some incredible hands-on dirty work and fun work with university program. And they get university credit for this as well.
That's amazing. I never did skeletal stuff when I was going in high school.
Yeah, in fact, the skeleton displays are in some of the classrooms at Thunder Mountain and also on display in some of the showcases. Very cool. Very, very cool. Our fish tech classes are working with DiPAC and Fish and Game, and they're incubating fish fry for Dredge Creek, putting it into Dredge Creek this spring, and they're learning about local fisheries. And that course is actually sponsored by DiPAC. It's a zero-hour class, and students from the district, any of the high schools, can be in it, and it's a full class right now. Our metals class students are fabricating dog obstacle course items for a local dog training program. So we're doing a lot of great community work and doing some hands-on skill building as well. If you never watch Channel 6, you should, because our video production show under Miko Wilson's help and teacher Leslie Knight do a weekly newscast, and it's put on Channel 6 every Friday. Our CAD students last semester worked with CBJ and local architects to design community projects, and the most recent project was downtown street lighting designs to consider. So that was pretty cool. We recently hosted the I Did a contest in honor and memory of Jan Niemeyer, a beloved art teacher in our district, and it was to showcase photo and digital arts, and it was K-12, and there were local winners just this week announced. And one high school student was chosen to take their photo to a state competition this month. So very exciting. Lots of talent. And our health science kids are busy working in job placements or shadowing at Bartlett Hospital and some other medical offices. And an ETT class just started this week after school for kids to get ETT trained.
You have to tell me what ETT stands for.
Emergency Trauma Technician Training. It's kind of one step below EMT, emergency medical technician training. So it's right before being an official paramedic, but it can serve students ages 14 and up. So there are more kids that can be in that kind of class. And they get high school and university credit, so it's super cool.
It's interesting to learn vocational education was learning how to pound a hammer, use a hammer.
That's right. It's much more than just that, you know. It's career training. That's why we call it career and technical ed, and they call it CTE. That's the acronym month for it. But, you know, there's wonderful things to celebrate in our schools, and so I feel good that we can share some of that even when we're in some really challenging times with our budget cuts. So I hope these programs will survive that because those are the challenges facing our community. Some other big highlights that I wanted to mention, especially something for right now. Tonight at Thunder Mountain High School at 5:30 is College Goal Alaska. And so it's open to all high school students and families at 5:30 at Thunder Mountain High School. They will get help on how to fill out the FAFSA form, which is a financial aid form for post-secondary education. So tonight at Thunder Mountain High School at 5:30. And then tomorrow and the next day, between JD High and Thunder Mountain High School, at lunch each day, there's a summer job fair. So there are a lot of summer businesses that are coming to recruit kids for summer jobs. And that'll be tomorrow at JD High and the next day at Thunder Mountain during lunch.
It looks like you get some students going to the robotics competition.
And we've got a group of students, three teams worth are going to the state robotics competition because Carol May has done a great job with them in prepping them for this work. So those are some really cool highlights. And I guess the other thing to highlight is our high schools have some amazing career pathways, and JD High has career pathways in the trades and mechanics. They have engineering classes and fisheries classes and some business classes and health sciences. And Thunder Mountain High School has some fisheries and marine and environmental science classes that are career pathways as well, and health science courses, and even a little bit of trades and a culinary program. So, and a digital arts program out there. So they really have some great programs in our schools, and we try to get kids to at least figure out their interests and explore this because there's great opportunities.
How can parents find out more about what their students are up to?
Well, registration for courses for next school year start this week with rising seniors at JD High and at Thunder Mountain having information nights. And you'll have to check the school bulletins for those schedules. But the course catalogs have that information. I believe Thunder Mountain High School is doing a little mini course fair for students during the day. And at the registration events, the catalogs are provided, and teachers and staff provide some presentations about some unique programs. And so we do a lot of guidance for choosing your next year's classes and thinking about where you're going after high school, whether it's to post-secondary or into a job, and making sure that, you know, you're taking what you need and some things that'll get you to your interests and future interests.
Is all this information available online?
Yes. Each high school has a website that their catalogs, high school catalogs, are posted. And some of the highlights are also, for Career and Technical Ed Month, are also posted on the district website.
Karen Smolin, thank you so much for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add that I might have forgotten to ask?
I think I got it all, but thank you.
This is Bird Note. Near the city of Crato in northeastern Brazil lives a critically endangered little bird, the Araripe manakin. It's a little larger than a sparrow, and it lives on the slopes of a very small area in the Araripe Plateau.
And along these slopes, it's pretty heavily populated, so almost all the recordings that exist of this species have dogs or roosters in the background.
So Garrett Vinn of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is on a mission to capture a clean recording of this bird.
All right, so I'm getting my gear together to head off on this trail. I'm going to pack a bag full of camera gear. Important things are sunblock, always. I'm going to have a parabolic microphone and then a stereo microphone set up for recording. And a little notebook here. There's quite a few highly venomous snakes here. So I've got these snake-proof gaiters that I'll zip up to my ankle.
All right, so I'm in an area where I heard a manakin singing up ahead of me, so I'm going to drop my gear here and get my parabola hooked up, start trying to record. I'll kind of stealthily move through the under.
The critically endangered Araripe manakin, recorded by Garrett Vinn of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/Diamond Park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
Band is the music of the Lysander Piano Trio. They're performing in Juno this Saturday, February 6th at 7 o'clock at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. It's brought to you by the Juno Jazz and Classics people. Weather forecast for tonight, light rain and snow, mainly in the evening. Snow accumulation of about 1 inch expected, low temperatures around 33 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, rain mixed with snow in the morning within the Mendenhall Valley. Little or snow accumulation expected. Wednesday night, rain snow levels at 800 feet.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast.